Welcome to Role Playing History, a podcast where we explore the history of role playing games. I'm Wayne Davis, and I'll be your guide for today's tour. Episode 64, Solo Adventures. I told you last week that one of our YouTube viewers suggested this week's topic after watching our episode on tunnels and trolls. The viewer was M, and here's what they said. Quote, "Hi, great review of Tunnels and Trolls. Your summary of the game was excellent, and I particularly liked hearing you read some other reviews." End quote. We're going to skip ahead in the comment. Quote, "If you're looking for additional content to address in the future, I'd love to hear your thoughts on some of the TNT solo adventures, which you note are a strength of the game and that there are many. Thanks again." End quote. First off, thank you, M, for taking the time to comment on the video, as well as make a suggestion about future programming. Today, my friend, is that future. So, since I'm all about trying to bring you what you want to hear about, let's get into solo adventures. And for the record, while I'm going to spend about half the episode on the solo adventures tied to Tunnels and Trolls, I do intend to spread out and discuss adventures tied to other systems. So with all that in mind, let's crank up the tour bus and get this show on the road. Before we go any further, I think we need to define what exactly a solo adventure is. I mean, I get that you figured out that a solo adventure is one where one person plays by themselves, but I thought we might define it a bit finer than that. The easiest description I can give you are those choose-your-own-adventure books that much of my generation read when we were kids. I know we've talked about those on the show before, but for those who might be new to the program, a choose-your-own-adventure book, which came from multiple publishers with many different titles, is a book where you start on page one, but depending on the decisions you make as you go along, you flip the different pages in the book until you reach the conclusion. Which, by the way, there also are multiple endings because, again, you can make different choices in the game and that'll lead to different results. A solo tabletop role-playing game acts in very much the same fashion, though you're also using dice to make rolls for actions, though the actions you're rolling for vary from company to company and sometimes from book to book. A final component of the solo game, and what makes it feel like a group game, is that most of these adventures require you to create your own character and roll up stats, which you'll use to roll against as you play along. For a number of gamers, especially in the late 1970s and 80s, solo adventures were how they got hooked into role-playing games. And for a great many of them, it was the only way they could play for a very long time. Well, I mean, that and play by mail, but that's another show that we already did. Now, I do have to note that pretty much every major publisher of tabletop role-playing games stuck their toes into the solo adventure market at some point in the late 70s or 80s, but a few actually kept these on as a section of their company, basically permanently. Flying Buffalo actually made their solo adventures a large part of their company, which makes sense considering the company basically made its bones on play-by-mail. There was another line that was very popular, and it was co-created by a fellow, well, he shares a name with somebody we've name-dropped a number of times over the course of this series, Steve Jackson. We're going to get into that a little bit later in the show, and I'm going to explain why we're going to be talking about two Steve Jacksons in the game business. But that's in a minute. Since Tunnel and Trolls adventures were specifically requested for this show, we're going to do those first. After all, your wish is my command. Flying Buffalo published around 30 different solo adventures over the years, with the most recent being around 2019. While I could talk about this line all day, obviously we're not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to give the titles of the first and the last book in the line, then we're going to discuss some of those adventures individually so you'll kind of get a taste for what they're like. Alice in Weird World was the very first adventure in the Tunnels and Trolls line, and while it wasn't a traditional dungeon crawl, as the title would certainly indicate, it was a solo game. Written by Joel Marler, it was, as you might expect, based on Alice in Wonderland. Now, the original game gave you the opportunity to play as Alice or to create your own character. However, this game has been reprinted by Flying Buffalo Games and is available in print form either from their website or any number of other sites, including DriveThruRPG.com. In this version, you can play as Alice or either of two other pre-generated characters. This updated version is about 65 pages, but it's noted that a quick play version of the rules is provided just in case you don't have a copy of Tunnels and Trolls to play with. The first book in the line that our listener was probably referring to is Buffalo Castle, which was originally released in 1976, with re-releases in 1980 and 1982. This one was written by Rick Loomis and Elizabeth T. Danforth, who would both write some of the seminal products in the Tunnels and Trolls lines over the years. It's believed by a number of writers and historians that this title predated Choose Your Own Adventure books, which, since the first book in the line titled Choose Your Own Adventures is 1979, barring any information to the contrary that I don't possess and could not find, we're going to go with that. Demian's Gamebook webpage, which is on web.archive.org, yep, I had to dig a bit for resources for this show, provided a bit of background into the book, which I found was lacking from the larger, more popular sites. Those larger sites, by the way, were primarily looking to sell PDFs of the book, so I'm not overly surprised there wasn't a lot of info. Give you the background, give you the author, give you the date, quick summary, boom, here's how much we're selling it for. Anyway, the author of the piece, Castiglione, stated that the book for Buffalo Castle was a mere 30 pages, with 5 paragraphs per page. The author also noted that they'd felt a bit disappointed in that length because they'd been expecting more. Now, I'm not sure how old the writer was or when they played the game, but as someone born in the early 70s, 1973 to be exact, I was old enough when Buffalo Castle came out that I could have conceivably played it. I mean, I didn't. I actually played one or two of the adventures in the series we're discussing later on, but I can tell you that at that time, having 30 pages of adventure that I was the star of, it'd have been pure joy. Now, granted, I was 3 when the first printing came out, so obviously I didn't play that one. I was 7 for the second and 9 for the third, so I was also probably easily amused, but I'm not going to let the facts get in the way of a good story. How about that? It's also noted that Buffalo Castle is, unapologetically, a dungeon crawl. Again, this wasn't necessarily a new concept either. A lot of the adventures making their way down the pike in these early days of tabletop role-playing games were dungeon crawls. We as creators hadn't yet figured out how to alter the rules for overland adventures, and it was presumed by Gary Gygax that the whole purpose of being in the game was to head for the dungeon, kill all the monsters inside of it, loot all the treasure possible, and get back out and head back to town. And look, I'm not trying to negate the opinions or the feelings of this writer. They're absolutely entitled to their opinion. What I'm offering is my own take on it. Call it a difference of opinion, if you will. Castiglione did mention something rather interesting about this adventure. They noted that Buffalo Castle allowed for what they were calling a get-out-of-jail-free card. Yeah, I know, this isn't Monopoly, but I do get Castiglione's reference. Basically, what was allowed was that if you were fighting a monster and were just completely overwhelmed, you could make a level 1 saving throw on luck. Make that, and you could literally run for the exit. Matter of fact, I believe that's what the rule was actually called, run for the exit. And yeah, it did exactly what the rule said. You would haul ass for the exit. There was probably a random monster you'd have to fight on the way out, but you would literally run completely out of the dungeon. It's kind of cool when you think about it, because it would have been easy to just create one of those meat grinder adventures that cropped up in the late 70s and early 80s. You know what I'm talking about. Even though they said they were for a certain level, they were definitely more powerful than that, and you'd grind through multiple characters before you could finish the adventure. In this case, though, it makes sense to not do that, and that's where Flying Buffalo got it right. Create something fun for the player, give them a challenging adventure, but also give them a safety line they can use if the shit gets too deep. That's how you keep the customer coming back for more. Steve Jackson, no, not the Steve Jackson game Steve Jackson, reviewed Buffalo Castle for issue number 9 of the Space Gamer. He said, quote, "If you're into role-playing, you'll enjoy Buffalo Castle. If you're into solo role-play, buy it," end quote. Now, I want to get back to the point I made a few moments ago about creating what I call a meat grinder adventure. Flying Buffalo had gotten it right with Buffalo Castle and continued to get it right through several more solo adventures written by a number of creators, including Ken St. Andre, who created Tunnels and Trolls himself. However, in 1979, St. Andre strayed a wee bit over that line from dungeon crawl to meat grinder with the title Arena of Kazan. I think the title says quite a bit about the game, and though I couldn't find a ton of stuff online about it, what I did find confirmed my suspicions. This was a solo adventure with a lot of combat, and a lot of that combat was potentially unsurvivable. I mean, it's basically a gladiatorial-style combat in an arena. There's not a whole lot of gray area there, and not a whole lot of chances to just cut and run. Lauren Rivers reviewed the game for Space Gamer number 28, and the review was short and not so sweet. Quote, This adventure can be fun, but not recommended for highly valued characters. End quote. Now, I originally wasn't going to cover back-to-back releases in this line, but when I checked out the 1980 release, which was written by Michael Stackpole, who's written a lot of really good stuff over the years, I had to put it in the show. Titled Sewers of Oblivion, it had a rather unique premise to it. You're a successful adventurer who's been drinking in a local tavern. When you go to leave, you're jumped by what is described as a band of ruffians who take your treasure and magical stuff and toss it down into the sewers. The adventure is based around you heading down there, taking care of whatever monsters there might be, and getting your stuff back. Now, while this wasn't necessarily a brand new concept in storytelling, it did have the advantage of being a newer twist on the old story. Since most of the adventures that weren't dungeon crawls at the time had you escaping from prison, or kidnappers, or some sort of above-ground escape, having your stuff taken and tossed in a sewer, that was a pretty new one. As with all of the previous titles in the line, Sewers of Oblivion sold very well. However, while most reviewers raved about it, W.G. Armantrout took a slightly different approach. Quote, "This is a marvelous creation, but my regular characters wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. I recommend this only for those mythical people with 7th-level supermen." End quote. Armantrout's review, by the way, was in the Space Gamer number 51. Gamesmen of Kassar is the next title in the line I wanted to look at, though I have to remind you that I'm not covering all the titles in the line, so I've skipped a few to get to this. And while I'm thinking of it, you can see the list of the entire line in a number of different places, including under the Tunnels and Trolls listing on Wikipedia, which is where I started when I started going through all of this. Gamesmen of Kassar's premise is that some mystery businessman has come to town, purchased a building, and offered untold riches to those who could beat the challenges contained within the house. Written by Roy Cram, Gamesmen of Kassar stood out to me because it was the first game in the line that also listed the UK publication year. The US version dropped in 1982, while the UK version dropped in 1983. William Peschel gets the review credit for this one, and he wrote his in the Space Gamer number 62. He said, quote, "The physical quality of the solo adventure is excellent and up to Flying Buffalo standards. But in writing Gamesmen, Cram forgot to include anything to challenge the intellect of the player." End quote. Again, though, the adventure sold well, and the line carried on. So, as I struggled to find some more information about other games in the line, I found myself drawn back to a 1980 release from Ken St. Andre that took the solo adventure concept and turned it on its head. Called The Toughest Dungeon in the World, the player took on the character of a monster in a dungeon. Their entire mission was to attempt to gather money and resources while they tried to escape the dungeon. Like I said, a flip on the usual tabletop role-playing game idea. I should also note that it was the first entry in Flying Buffalo's solo adventure line to be released by the Judges Guild. We talked about them way earlier in the history of this podcast. The release turned out to be so popular, St. Andre hooked up with Trollhalla Press Unlimited in 2020 to release an updated 48-page second edition. So, if you're wanting to play this game, you should be able to find it at your friendly neighborhood local game shop, and if they don't have it in stock, ask them if they can order it for you. However, to play the second edition, you will need the most recent version of Monsters Monsters, so keep that in mind. Now, to this point in the show, I've only been including one review, but this adventure had two reviews that I thought you might find interesting, so here we go. The first one is from Forrest Johnson in the Space Gamer number 35. He said, quote, "Do you enjoy rolling dice for hours on end, even knowing the probability of a favorable outcome is slight? If you have better things to do with your time, there are better games on the market." End quote. The second comes from Anders Swenson in Different Worlds Magazine, who said, quote, "In evaluation, this is a well-done adventure with a crazy theme that everyone should try. Pity the poor troll, cowering in the dark depths, trying to get a small fortune together so he can escape to the outside world, free from the clutches of dungeon existence. It might make you want to take a troll to lunch." End quote. Two reviews, two very different perspectives. Okay, so I said I was going to mention the first and then the most recent entries in this line, so I need to mention the most recent. Titled Vault of Kahorror, it was brought to life through a Kickstarter that ended in July of 2018. It would be one of the final products Rick Loomis would see released as he died in August of 2019. Vault of K'horror is both a solo adventure and a GM adventure, which means it can either be played as a solo or with a group. Ken St. Andre handled the solo adventure, while Andy Holmes handled the GM adventure. Vault of K'horror is a fantasy game with a gothic twist as the adventurer, or group, depending, enters a vault, more like a dungeon, chock full of vampires and other undead. The solo adventure clocks in at 19 pages, while the GM adventure is a bit more than 40. As the Kickstarter took in almost $11,000 on a $7,000 goal, I'd say it was something gamers were looking for. And what we're starting to see, as the request we got for this particular show would prove, is that there's a good amount of nostalgia for these games. Like I said before, for a whole lot of us, and I include myself in that, solo adventures were how we cut our teeth. We didn't necessarily have a lot of people who were willing to play with us at the time, though I had three friends that would play with me at recess, at least until something more interesting came along. Remember, the late 70s and early 80s brought various satanic and occultic panics concerning role-playing games, and heavy metal, if we're being honest, but this is a show about games. Anyway, with all of that going on, once some parents found out their kids were playing those blasphemous games, they weren't allowed to anymore. So a lot of people, a whole lot of people, got into solo adventures. Now, again, I know that's not the only reason why people played them. I'm just trying to provide some additional context. I'd also add that these solo adventures were in many cases better written and the adventures better explained than anything you'd buy to play with a group. They had to be. Next up on our tour is a line of solo adventures that I actually played a few from. Fighting Fantasy. Created by Steve Jackson, the reviewer and founder of Games Workshop, and Ian Livingstone, the majority of the books in the line were fantasy games, much like the titles from Flying Buffalo. However, there were some post-apocalyptic, horror, and other genres thrown in from time to time, though they typically got their own miniseries, so as not to confuse the fantasy gamer. The series was launched in 1982 and published by Puffin Books, which was the children's book publishing arm of Penguin Random House. Yep, that's right. A children's book company actually published role-playing books in the early 1980s. Now, Puffin, and Penguin for that matter, are British companies based in London, so that's probably got something to do with it, as the satanic panics about role-playing games weren't quite as bad in the UK as they were in the US at the time. They were still there, but I don't think they were nearly as bad. The origins of Fighting Fantasy came from a discussion Jackson and Livingstone had with Geraldine Cook, who was an editor at Penguin at the time. They originally sold her on what they called a book about the role-playing game hobby. They sold it as an introductory book, where they'd explain what the games are and how to play them. Somewhere along the line, they decided that they'd rather have an interactive book than the somewhat dry book they were working on. It took some convincing, but Cook ultimately gave them the green light. Work on the first book began sometime in 1980 and ultimately saw the light of day in 1982. Now, this line was hella successful, and the titles just kept getting cranked out. Jackson and Livingstone wrote some of them, but many others were either written by other authors they admired or that they wanted to give a break into the industry to. In fact, one of the writers on a couple of the books was Steve Jackson. No, not the Steve Jackson who created the line, the other Steve Jackson. You know, the fellow who started Steve Jackson's games. You confused yet? All right, let me do this. I'm going to really screw you up. When Steve Jackson Games' Steve Jackson wrote his Fighting Fantasy books, the author credit said, Steve Jackson. When the Puffin Steve Jackson wrote his Fighting Fantasy books, the author credit said, Steve Jackson. So if you're holding a Fighting Fantasy book written by Steve Jackson, unless you just happen to know which one wrote it, you just kind of have to treat it like Schrodinger's book. It both is and isn't written by Steve Jackson. From 1983 to 1985, our Steve Jackson, don't worry, I'm not mentioning the other one again in this show, wrote a line called Sorcery. It used the same concepts as Fighting Fantasy, but rather than it being aimed at children, it was aimed at a more adult audience. Over the years, Jackson took the concept and stories from these solo adventures and eventually published them for full group use, or GM games as Flying Buffalo would call them. Fighting Fantasy, the introductory role-playing game, was released in 1984 and was followed up in 1989 by Advanced Fighting Fantasy, which, much like AD&D, was meant to be a more advanced version of the game. There's one more thing I wanted to hit here before I moved on with the history, and that's another use for Fighting Fantasy that Steve Jackson came up with. In 1988, Jackson teamed up with Computer Dial to release the game Fantasy Interactive Scenarios by Telephone, or FIST for short. The idea is in the name there, folks. These were solo adventures played over the phone. The idea was that the player could create their character over the phone, and it would be saved as a profile for when they called back again to play more. Players would hear the narrative about what was going on as they listened in, and when it was time to make a move, they could press the button or buttons needed to take the action they needed to take. Another thing about FIST was that there were sound effects included in the audio, which, according to those who played the game, really enhanced the experience. There were two titles released for this system, Castle Mammon, Lair of the Demon Prince in September of 1988, and Castle Mammon, Lair of the Demon Prince in September 1988. Puffin got out of the game in 1995, and the line was just left to be. However, Wizard Books picked up the license in 2002, and while they initially only did reprints of the older books, they did work in a few new titles along the way. Wizard dropped the license in 2012, but Scholastic Books picked it up in 2017, and they hold that license to this day. And, much like Wizard, they primarily do reprints of old adventures, though they do publish new ones from time to time. Alright, so we've gotten the history. Let's take a look at some of the books in the line. The Warlock of Firetop Mountain was the very first book released. As I mentioned, it was written by Jackson and Livingstone, and it involved the adventurer seeking a powerful warlock who was living hidden under Firetop Mountain. Unlike the Flying Buffalo games, these games were massive. Each book in the line came in at a minimum of 380 pages, but most were at least 400. This one, 400 pages. So comparing to Flying Buffalo's games, that's 10 times the number of pages, which would mean possibly 10 times more adventuring. And how about some reviews? Nicholas J.R. Dugan reviewed The Warlock of Firetop Mountain in White Dwarf 36. He gave it an overall rating of 10 out of 10 and stated that, quote, "The book would make an ideal present for anyone who has expressed an interest in role-playing games, or indeed any young brother or sister. I imagine that the minimum age would be about 10, but I would recommend it to novice and veteran players alike for quite a few hours of entertainment," end quote. In a retrospective review of The Warlock of Firetop Mountain in Blackgate, Matthew David Surridge said, quote, "Modern games are more forgiving than Warlock, I think. Still, all in all, I think the book format may be best. There's a certain effect the mix of image and text gives you that I can't imagine in any other formats. All told, I'm glad I picked the book up again. There's magic in Firetop Mountain yet," end quote. The Warlock of Firetop Mountain spawned two sequels. The first, Return to Firetop Mountain, was written by Livingstone and released in 1992. Now, while it is a return to a familiar setting, Livingstone managed to make some major changes from the initial book to this one. First, the adventurer actually has to adventure their way to the mountain. In the first book, this wasn't the case. Second, while there are some things that are similar to the original, Livingstone almost completely changed the mapping and layout of the mountain's interior so that those who played the original game wouldn't have an advantage. By the way, I call that proactively dealing with metagaming. Just saying. If you're curious as to how well this book sold, all you need to know is that Puffin was going to end the line with this title, which was the 50th in the line. However, it sold so well, they kept the line going for 3 more years. If that ain't success, I don't know what is. No reviews of this title for you, but I think what it did to save the line should tell you how much it was liked and appreciated. The second sequel is called Legend of Zagor. It was credited to Livingstone, but it's been reported that what he provided to the book was the title and a little bit of setting information. The bulk of the heavy lifting on this title was done by Carl Sargent. Zagor was a favorite character of his, so writing a story with him as a part of it was something he jumped at the chance to do. It was originally released in 1993, and while it didn't sell as well as the previous two books, it sold well enough for this line to continue into 1995. For this game, the idea is that Zagor didn't die, even though the player was led to believe he had. Instead, he was banished from Titan, which is the world of fighting fantasy, and has settled in the Castle Argent on Amarilla. This is the only book in this part of the line that was set in Amarilla, but one could understand why a change of scenery was made, as the first two books took place in essentially the same place. One major change with this title is that the player had a choice between four different characters to play: a barbarian, a dwarf, a wizard, or a warrior. Each has its own strengths and weaknesses, but at least the player has a choice. The idea of the game is to adventure along and try to pick up treasure and silver daggers and golden totems for the final battle. Is Zagor really dead? Only time will tell. Once again, I don't have a review of this book, but from what I read from fans and players, the reviews were slightly mixed. Some players felt a little let down by this third installment, while others appreciated the differences enough to be satisfied. There were 59 books published in the Puffin portion of the game line. We already covered the first, so let's take a look at the last. Curse of the Mummy was written by Jonathan Green and released in 1995. In this book, the player is charged with locating the tomb of Akaris in the Desert of Skulls. See, he's dead and about to rise from it, alive and well. And if that happens, all of Alencia will become his slaves. So, no pressure or anything. While a number of gamers really liked this book, I found a large number that had that meh feeling and didn't seem too disappointed that the series came to a close. Of course, we already know Wizard picked up the line in 2002. I do need to point out that while Wizard did a lot of reprints of Puffin titles, they didn't necessarily publish them in the same order as Puffin did. So a book that was 20th in the Puffin line, for example, might be 4 or 5 in the Wizard line. By the way, I'm not saying that's exactly how the numbering went for the 20th book in the Puffin line. I was just using those numbers as an example. What did stay as it was the fact that The Warlock of Firetop Mountain was the first book released by Wizard. I mean, hey, don't fix it if it ain't broken. Wizard did two main series, one that ran from 2002 to 2007, and another that ran from 2009 to 2012. They were called Series 1 and Series 2. And The Warlock of Firetop Mountain was the first book released for both series. Series 1 saw three new books released for it. The first was Eye of the Dragon, written by Livingstone and released in 2005. We're going to look at the second original, which was the Jonathan Green book, Bloodbones. Released in 2006, Bloodbones was initially supposed to be the 60th book in the Puffin line of fighting fantasy books. However, when the line was canceled, the book was just sort of lost for 10 years. However, Green himself had reported in 2001 that he still had the completed book, and he and Livingstone had told the story about when it was supposed to have been published, and that's the story I just shared with you. So with Wizard now holding the license and looking for a new title or two to drop, Bloodbones got the call. Officially, it's listed as the 26th title in the Wizard line. As all other books, with one exception in the fighting fantasy line, Bloodbones is set up on Titan. This time, the adventurer is seeking the pirate lord Cinnabar. Cinnabar murdered the adventurer's family, and they're out for revenge. But, plot twist, Cinnabar is actually dead. He was revived with voodoo magic, so the adventurer has to head to the Port of Crabs to start the search for his hideout. Ultimately, the character comes into conflict with both the undead and fully resurrected versions of Cinnabar, and will take on his god, Quizcari. Oh, and for anybody giving me shit for naming an NPC in my Deadlands game the Muffin Man, Cinnabar? Really? There are code words utilized throughout the book that record some of the events that transpire. One player who shared their experiences noted that the concept of time or a timer is mentioned a few times early in the book, but gets dropped about midway through and is never mentioned again. And there are no reviews that I'm going to drop here either. Howl of the Werewolf is not only the third original title in this first series, it's also the final title in the first series. And it's been noted on more than one occasion that it's the only wholly original book released in this series, as Eye of the Dragon built on a previous work and Bloodbones had technically been written for Puffin. Howl of the Werewolf, however, was completed for Wizard. Written by Jonathan Green and released in 2007, the adventure takes place in Luprevia. The scenario involves the character heading for Castle Wolfen to find a cure for their lycanthropy. The adventure concludes with a battle against Count Varkolok. Many readers of the book appreciated the difference in style and setting from previous books, while others ranted that changing the setting ruined the book for them. In the second Wizard series, there were also three new books released. Stormslayer, written by Jonathan Green and released in 2009, and Knight of the Necromancer, also written by Jonathan Green and released in 2010. The third book didn't get an official Wizard release number, but it's the final book of Final Fantasy that was released by Wizard. Titled Blood of the Zombies, it saw Ian Livingstone get back in the saddle, and it released in 2012. Livingstone went back to the well, or in this case, back to Firetop Mountain. A major change is that the book is set in the modern day. The reader plays a character kidnapped and sold to a deranged megalomaniac who's bent on revenge against those who've mocked him. He intends to get his revenge by building an army of undead and has an army of scientists working to make this happen. The scientists have developed a mutated gene in human blood that will turn humans that are injected with it into zombies, and the player is one of the final to be injected. Your job is to avoid getting injected, escape your confines, and gear up so you can kill everybody who's involved with your capture, including the zombies. There are a few surprises along the way, and Livingstone pointed out that he took this title in directions he hoped nobody was expecting. As we mentioned earlier, Scholastic picked up the line in 2017, and like Wizard before them, they released The Warlock of Firetop Mountain first. There have been 4 new titles released in the line to this point out of the 19-book release. However, the line isn't finished yet. Books 20 and 21 are set to be released in September of 2022, with Ian Livingstone writing Shadow of the Giants and Steve Jackson taking on Secrets of Salamonis. And you know this series is a labor of love. Steve Jackson is 71, and Ian Livingstone will be 73 in December. And I'm not saying you can't keep producing as you get older, but to stick with the same series of books through multiple publishers for more than 40 years, that is dedication and love for you. And that, my dear listeners, is the end of our tour for today. I want to thank our YouTube fan, M, for the suggestion for today's show. If you've got a topic you'd like to see me deep dive on this podcast, hit me up. All the ways you can do it are coming up in just a moment. When you get the chance, I'd appreciate it if you'd check out our other podcast, Bad GM's Campaign Build Along. We're building a Deadlands Classic game from scratch that you could run for your group starting tonight, if you're so inclined. The early episodes are also a primer for those who might not have run or played Deadlands before, so they're going to be well worth the listen. Bad GM's Campaign Build Along is available wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, badgmproductions.net. The music we use for this show comes from pixabay.com. Check them out for license-free, royalty-free music for your next project. Role-Playing History is a production of Bad GM Productions. Check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/gaming/badgmprod. Twitter, you can find us at BadGMP, YouTube, BadGM Productions, email, badgmproductions@gmail.com, and online at badgmproductions.net. By the way, at the website, we have links to all of the other ways you can reach us. So if you need to reach out, head to the website and take care of it. And this is a special note for all of our listeners that have been listening to this podcast on the Role Playing History YouTube channel. As you are listening to this, this will be the final show released on that channel. Beginning with episode 65, we'll be putting this show on the Bad GM Productions channel only, so make sure you head over there, subscribe, and hit the bell so you don't miss out. So, we're at the end of the show, and I haven't announced what's coming up next week yet. I really think we need to deep dive some more games, so let's do 3 of them. Next week, we'll check out Aberrant, Basic Role-Playing, and Chivalry and Sorcery. 3 very different thoughts, so make sure you catch the show. That's next week, though. So until then, I'm Wayne Davis, and your Role Playing History.